Hello and welcome to the Margin Driving Podcast number 91. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around I'm doing a couple of small British films, British science fiction films in fact, from 1965. They both have the same producer and the same writer. The first one is a 1965 science fiction drama, of course, called The Earth Dies Screaming, starring Willard Parker and Virginia Field and Dennis Price. And then the second one is a much more obscure one, Spaceflight IC-1, starring Bill Williams and Norma West. So sit back, I will get the contact details out of the way, and we'll get this show on the road. Martian Driving Podcast is a fortnightly podcast of science fiction, horror, fantasy, and film appreciation. It doesn't matter when it comes from, whether it's old or new, in black and white, in colour, 3D, anamorphic. It doesn't matter. If it's interesting, I'm going to give it a go. Now, there are occasionally also roundtable discussions where I get a few like-minded cronies around and we talk about science fiction or horror or fantasy or anything that takes our mind, so the format's kind of loose. Now, you can contact me and leave feedback via feedbackpaleo, that's feedback, P-A-L-E-O, at gmail.com. You can go to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook and have a chat there with me and other people about science fiction, fantasy, horrors, or any other kind of things you want to talk about. Apart from politics, I've got another area for that. Please be aware that this podcast does have swearing in it. So if you're going to be listening to it on speakers, make sure there are no children around, unless you want them to learn wider vocabulary than they already have. Hi, how's everybody going? It's still winter here, which is not a good thing. The good guys lost the election, but on the other side of things, my cold is diminishing rapidly, which is always a good thing. And on the third side of things, Sally's currently in a hospital. She, as some people know, she does have depression issues. And so we put her into a local clinic for about a week and a half, maybe, just to let her meds that she's on balance out and to give us some support. She's allowed out with me during the daytime and things like that, but we just needed to do this as a way of ensuring that she gets the help that she needs, and things are going well. Yes, she's managing well. She was home for a number of hours today, and there's a good prognosis for her, so that's all kind of positive as well. Last night, though, I did go out and hung out with some friends, Jamie and Sarah, and we ate food, watched Turbo Kid, which is a fine retro 80s movie made in 2015. If you haven't seen Turbo Kid, I do recommend it. It's a lot of fun. It's got a lot of homages to 1980s science fiction movies of a certain type and a certain budget. It's very aware of what it is, and it's done something that science fiction movies to some extent have forgotten, and that is, it's fun. It's an enjoyable thing. It's got Michael Ironside playing the big bad villain with an eye patch and an attitude, and that's kind of cool. So if you haven't seen that, highly recommend it. It's very much the kind of film that people who like Martian Driving Podcasts will definitely like. Now, what else have I watched? I kind of sat around grooving Netflix for a bit and watched an old movie from 1960, which is kind of a redundant thing to say, I suppose. But I rewatched Breakfast at Tiffany's with Audrey Hepburn, of course, Patricia Neal, George Peppard, that horrible Mickey Rooney Japanese guy, and Buddy Ebsen. And I was having a chat with Jamie last night about Breakfast at Tiffany's and said, one of the interesting things about it is, even though people are charmed and they find it a romantic movie and it's a lovely film and it's got Henry Mancini's score, it's got Audrey Hepburn with a little guitar singing Moon River on a tenement window ledge. In spite of that, the characters aren't very nice. She takes advantage of guys by getting them to finance her life. He's a kept man to Patricia Neal's character. And neither of them is particularly a kind of admirable person. But the charm of the movie is that Blake Edwards, the director, makes it work for some reason, which is kind of strange. Of course, it's based on a short novel by Truman Capote. But both Holly Golightly and Paul Varjak aren't particularly nice people. It's kind of like, in a softer way, the Thomas Crown Affair, because that's a love affair between two bastards, as it was called. And this one's a kind of love affair between two people who use other people. But it's a very light studio film from the 1960s, made a hell of a lot of money. It's been very influential on fashion and on a number of young women who kind of look slightly like Audrey Hepburn. But yeah, it's a. Doesn't mean I didn't enjoy the film. I absolutely enjoyed the film, but I enjoyed it in a more complicated way than I had previously, by having that understanding about the nature of the characters involved. It's a very well-made piece of cinema. Buddy Ebsen's very good in it, playing Doc. I won't do any spoilers on where his character comes in. Martin Balsam's in there and does a pretty good turn as well. Patricia Neal showing a lot of class and a role which could very easily have not had it. But yeah, Breakfast at Tiffany's, I really should do it for future Paleo Cinema. And while I'm on the subject of movies I intend to do for a future podcast, I saw a 1970 William Friedkin movie called The Boys in the Band, based on the play by Mark Crowley. And it's about a bunch of gay friends in New York in the late 1960s who get together for a party. It's a very influential play and film, because for the first time in American cinema, it really kind of had complex gay characters talking about what it was like living gay in an environment where there was an enormous amount of hostility towards them. They could be hassled by police. It really does kind of give a picture of the time. And the acting is uniformly good, because most of the original cast of the play are in the film, which makes it, well, the characters feel very lived in and well rehearsed. It's just a lovely piece of work. Very good direction by Friedkin. He does a marvellous job on a fairly small set. I don't know whether it was a set or a location shot. I think it's a set. And there's only a couple of people you may know in the film. Lawrence Luckinbill, who played Cybok, Spock's brother in one of the Star Trek movies, and Cliff Gorman, who was in All That Jazz, playing the kind of Lenny Bruce slash Dustin Hoffman character in All That Jazz. They're in this film, and they're both very good. I think it's a very important film. What I want to do is try to find a gay friend to talk about this film with me in a future Paleo Cinema podcast, because I want to have my viewpoint, but I also want a viewpoint of a gay person when I talk about it. So that's something I'm looking forward to doing, and I think Boys in the Band may be a good matchup with a movie like Joseph Losey's Victim, perhaps. I think they make a killer double feature for future Paleo Cinema. Let's see, what else have I been putting my eyes across? As I said, I saw Turbo Kid. I did see the Sacha Baron Cohen movie Grimsby, which also stars Mark Strong. And the conceit in this comedy is that the best secret agent Britain has a brother who's a North of England soccer hooligan. And things go drastically wrong, of course. And, yeah, there's lots of spy action. It was directed by Louis Leterrier, who did a number of pretty good action films. It didn't go the direction I thought it would. It kind of steered off into another path, which is kind of cool. There's a lot of gross-out humour in it. In fact, there's a shit of a lot of gross-out humour in there. So if that's not your kind of thing, you might want to avoid Grimsby. But I found it kind of amusing and diverting, and it really does transgress in an amusing way. So I kind of enjoyed that more than I thought I would. It's not a guilty pleasure, but it is definitely, very definitely, a vulgar pleasure. Okay, so I'm going to take the first break of the podcast now, and to amuse you while I do, here is Miss Ella Fitzgerald.
Saucer flew down to earth one day. Looked to left and right of it, couldn't stand the sight of it, and said, "Let's fly away." They took a look at a Western movie, somebody heard them say, If a horse can be a star, think how dumb the people are. We'd better fly away. Then they shook their little green antennas, scratched their purple hair, said this planet is an awful menace. Let's go back to where we came from. Two little men in a flying saucer just didn't care to stay.
No,
said it's too peculiar here, headed for the stratosphere, and quickly flew away.
A left in Mebbets Field in Brooklyn when the Dodgers played a baseball game.
Hey!
Heard all the screaming, said we must be dreaming, cause the planet is insane.
During their mission, heard a politician making speeches as they traveled by.
Gabble, gabble, gabble. But they departed faster than they started, cause the hot air blew them sky high.
Two little men in a flying saucer flew down to Earth one day. Listened to a radio, saw a television show, and said, let's fly away. They got their fill of commercial jingles, and they were heard to say, all the people seem to be living in a nursery, we'd better fly away. Traveled all around, and once they'd seen us, said, let's head for space. We were better off on Mars and Venus.
Goodness, what a place to live in.
Two little men in a flying saucer just didn't care to stay.
No, no.
Crossed a crowded thoroughfare,
saw the hats the women wear,
and quickly flew away. And quickly flew away. One look and then they flew away.
Who knew that Ella Fitzgerald did a science fiction song? But, in fact, she did. Now, on to the movies that I'm going to talk about. The Earth Dies Screaming and Spaceflight IC-1. Both of them were produced by the same guy, a guy called Robert L. Lippert. Lippert was born in 1909 and died in 1976, and was a kind of B or C grade movie producer, in spite of which he kind of had something to do with a fair few really interesting lower budget films. I was looking through his IMDb on the producer credits, and they were more impressive than I thought they would be. Let's have a look. I'll just kind of hit the high notes of this. The Baron of Arizona, the Sam Fuller movie with Vincent Price, and he was the executive producer on that, uncredited. He was an executive producer of The Steel Helmet, another really fine early Sam Fuller movie with an actor called Gene Evans, who basically created the stereotype of the hard-bitten army sergeant. Gene Evans did that. If you haven't seen The Steel Helmet, I recommend you see it. He did a deal with Hammer Films in the late 1950s, and he was also the executive producer on, well, the producer on the movie version of The Quatermass Experiment. He was a producer on the original version of The Fly, a film I've talked about on Paleo Cinema, The Cabinet of Caligari, the 1962 version based on a Robert Bloch script. He was a producer on it. He was a producer on The Last Man on Earth, the Vincent Price movie from 1964. And Curse of the Fly, of course. The Return of Mr. Moto, which is a bugfuck crazy film with Henry Silver playing Mr. Moto. If you haven't seen The Return of Mr. Moto, track it down and find it. But in 64 and 65, and the dates of these two films that I'm going to talk about in the podcast vary a little bit. In 64, he did The Earth Dies Screaming, according to IMDb. And in 1965, he produced Spaceflight IC-1, An Adventure in Space, which is the other film I'm going to talk about this time. By the way, before I go any further, I should tell you, Both of these films that I'm going to talk about are up on YouTube. You can find them with very little effort. I think they may have fallen into the public domain because Lippert Pictures, Robert Lippert's production company, collapsed not too long after these films. And so the ownership of the films is kind of, yeah, very much up in the air. So they've fallen into the public domain, which from our point of view is not a bad thing. The scripts for both of the movies were written by a guy called Harry Spaulding, who was a Canadian who migrated to America and wrote something like 18 original scripts in 3 years, some of them under a pseudonym. So people, he said he didn't want people to think that the only writer in Hollywood was Harry Spaulding. So he used a number of different pseudonyms, including Henry Cross, and produced, was really prolific for a short period of time, and then kind of faded from view. One of the other films he did was a movie called Watcher in the Woods, which was done for Disney. I think it may have had Betty Davis in it. But Harry Spaulding kind of, you know, tapped pretty well into science fiction. He knew the genre well, and that's fairly obvious from the scripts for The Earth Dies Screaming and Spaceflight IC-1. He was very familiar with the genre as it was at the time, which is to his credit as well. It's a bit like somebody writing a script for a Western, for instance, and not doing at least basic homework on the time and place. Science fiction always gets a short shrift, in particularly in the 1950s and 1960s. People just didn't give a fuck too much about the science. And so for sticklers of accuracy like me, those movies are always problematic. But these two are actually not too bad. They kind of don't go into elaborate and complex science. They keep it pretty basic, common knowledge stuff from the mid-1960s, and they don't fuck it up, which is all credit to Harry Spaulding and, of course, Robert Lippert for doing that. But I'm going to do them in kind of reverse chronological order and talk about Spaceflight IC-1 first.
Of the beginning, the year is 2015. Mission: to build a new civilization as astronauts hurtle through deep space to save the world or destroy themselves aboard Spaceflight IC-1.
This is Captain Meade Ralston, spaceship IC-1.
You could turn back.
Agreed. I think we should.
You know that's out of the question.
You killed my wife.
I won't hesitate for one moment to blow this spaceship
to kingdom come.
See life in the 21st century. See the brain that lives without a body. See humans frozen for rebirth in space. See the astronaut experiment that turns men into monsters.
Now I'm going to read you the plot summary from Wikipedia, sorry. In the year 2015, spaceship IC-1, Interstellar Colony 1, travels toward a planet similar to Earth to explore the possibility that the population problem on Earth can eventually be solved there. IC-1's crew consists of Captain Meade Ralston, Bill Williams, his wife Jan, Norma West, Doctors Stephen and Helen Thomas, played by John Kearney and Linda Marlowe, two other married couples, and four people in suspended animation. 1 year into the voyage, Helen is found to have a fatal pancreatic infection that can only be cured if the ship returns to Earth. But Captain Ralston refuses to turn back, and when he's denied permission to have another child, she commits suicide. And I'm not going to spoil the end of it for you. Both of these movies, by the way, are bloody short ones. Spaceflight IC-1 runs 65 minutes, and The Earth Dies Screaming runs 62 minutes, so they're not padded out to kind of fill a slot, unless it was the bottom part of a double feature or the top part of a double feature. The lesser films usually at the start of old school double features, as I recall. But nonetheless, you know, really low budget, short running time, produced as kind of fillers for lesser cinemas. The kind of tentpole pictures tended to play the really large, grandiose cinemas, and lesser films were in the suburban cinemas, which is one of the reasons why my passion for films is the kind of shallow end of the things, let's say. But this one's kind of interesting. It stars Bill Williams, who is the father of William Catt, the guy who played Ralph in The Greatest American Hero. And they do look very similar. I have vague and distant memories of Bill Williams in a TV series which played interminably well into the 1960s in Australia called The Adventures of Kit Carson, which was actually filmed between 1951 and 1955, and they did 103 episodes, so it was one of those series that went into syndication. He then did another TV series called Date with the Angels, and another one called Assignment Underwater, which was 39 episodes in 1960-1961. Never had a great career. He started out, he was one of those guys who was kind of grabbed by the studios after having a career as a professional swimmer, performing in underwater shows. He actually knocked back the role that Lloyd Bridges played in Sea Hunt, much to his chagrin, because it became a very, very popular TV series. Not a really gifted actor, particularly Bill Williams, but he was one of those kind of American He-Man actors that filled a certain role in a certain kind of picture on a certain budget at a certain time. And the interesting thing is, too, there were a lot of these kind of actors who went over to England to play in genre films in the 1950s and 1960s. People like Brian Donlevy and Dean Jagger and a bunch of others kind of came, Forrest Tucker as well, went over to England. And because they had a certain name value, they were useful in promoting kind of lower budget, particularly genre films at the time. And contrary to the usual pattern of these kind of actors in certain kind of roles, in this one, Bill Williams isn't the hero the way that Willard Parker is in The Earth Dies Screaming. He's actually the villain of the piece. The captain of the spaceship is the villain of the piece. He's part of a world government that took over sometime in the last 20 years. Got to remember, this movie is set in 2015, just last year. A kind of totalitarian government called Rule, which is a very cool name for a totalitarian government. It's a very skiffy kind of name. Kind of think 21st century Nazis, if you absolutely have to do a parallel. So Captain Ralston is an authoritarian captain. And to be honest with you, this spaceship is set up pretty fucking shabbily in a number of ways. My theory is that it's actually a PR stunt by Rule to prove that they can go to other solar systems. Because here's what they do. They've got a 25-year journey across space to go to a new planet to set up a colony. For a start, there are only about 10 people and four kids, on this spaceship. That's not a viable breeding population to start with. Best estimates for a viable human breeding population is 200 to 400, if I recall rightly, and I'm sure that if I'm wrong, somebody like our friend Elaine is going to correct me on that, but it's around that figure. If you see anything where, any movie or TV series, where they have a colony population of anything less than that, without constant ships going back and forth, it's really hasn't done its homework in that sense. Human diversity requires that amount, otherwise you end up with a whole bunch of inbred people, and that's not the way you particularly want to go with an interstellar colony. So that's one flaw there. And then another flaw is that Rule is a really sexist organization, because the kids that are sent out on the interstellar flight with their parents are all boys, with the plan that, you know, a couple of years down the line, a couple of years out, the parents will breed girls to marry the boys in the future. So, of course, that kind of sets up a couple of things. A, the guys have got to be older. And B, even though they never mentioned it, they've got some way of selecting the gender of a child. So you send 8 people out on an interstellar colonization ship. I think the number is limited by the budget of the movie more than it is by not thinking through the science. But it does allow for some very, very human things. And the movie does actually address one of them, which is, what if one of the people falls out of love with their spouse and just can't stand them anymore? Even though you can kind of select people for emotional stability, putting them in a giant tin can for 25 years is going to bring up unforeseen flaws, particularly when there are only 7 other adults for you to interact with, as well as, I think it's 3 children at this time, because one of the other problems with the interstellar colony ship is that Captain Ralston and his wife have not had a child, and there's some implication that he's either impotent or infertile. I'm going to go with impotent because he does have a lot of psychological problems. He's nasty, authoritarian, a stickler for the rules. He's just not the sort of person that any sane person would have running an enterprise of this kind. He's Captain Queeg in a spaceship, essentially. Captain Queeg being the Humphrey Bogart character in the Kane Mutiny movie, which you should see as well. I keep thinking that today I'm thinking of all these movies I want to do for Paleo Cinema Podcast when I'm supposed to be talking about Martian Drive-In Podcast. But I'm adding the Kane Mutiny to the Paleo Cinema list. And all this stuff is kind of why the movie is interesting. They're discussing and taking seriously the problems you'd have on a spaceship, the problems of what if somebody has an unforeseen illness, which indeed happens to Helen Thomas, the doctor. What do you do about relationship breakdowns? What do you do when the captain is an authoritarian who won't even let you celebrate the first year of their space flight by letting you get into the pharmaceutical cabinet and having a couple of drugs to cheer yourselves up? The movie is quite interesting from those points of view. It raises those issues. It doesn't necessarily deal with them in any effective way, but it does acknowledge them and it does bring them to a certain point to our attention. And yeah, it's one of those things where you think, yeah, well, that's right, that would happen in a spaceship. And what do we do about that? And what do we do when the person who's the spaceship's educator steers away from the party line as far as history lessons are concerned? There's a little bit between the captain and the teacher where the captain kind of addresses that issue and is not happy that she's teaching the children what a bad thing rule is back on Earth. But that then brings up a secondary issue as well. When you've got 8 adults on a spaceship, how do you punish someone? How do you kind of, you know, enforce the rules when you're a year away from the people who created those rules? Captain Rawson does have one ace up his sleeve. He has a key which, if you turn it in a certain lock aboard the ship, will blow up the ship. So basically he's got the ultimate power of life and death. But nonetheless, there's no kind of effective policing of the crew of the spaceship. All you've got is the ultimate threat of killing everybody on board, which ultimately, if people don't think you're going to do it, is a very ineffective way of wielding the big stick. Spaceflight IC-1 bites off much, much more than it can chew. It raises these issues that this is kind of stuff that TV and movies weren't really addressing very much at the time. There were, of course, things like The Twilight Zone and Outer Limits, which did go into the moral problems of people in certain kinds of environments like this, but not to the degree this movie does, in a running time which isn't much longer than an episode of The Twilight Zone. Of course, the sets are very kind of rudimentary and generic, and the actors that they get to play the roles, apart from Bill Williams, and I've already talked about his limitations as an actor, are very much stage-trained English kind of jobbing actors who aren't particularly good. They've kind of got the posh theatrical accents, and apart from Bill Williams, even though they do say it is a US, Canada and a UK space flight under rule, everybody apart from Bill Williams' character Mead Ralston seems to come from the southeast of England. It'd be nice if they had put a Scouser in there or something like that, but that really didn't happen. That isn't to say that the actors are bad in what they're doing, it's just that they're not kind of vivid and lived-in characters. In a 65-minute movie, you don't have a lot of time for backstory, you don't have a lot of time for character development. Everybody, we understand who everybody is pretty well from the start because they're all wearing badges saying what their function is on the spaceship. This movie very much plays like one of those one-off plays for today that England did on television. I think the BBC did them in the 1960s and 1970s, where you could do a one-off and tell a standalone story and have at it in that way. And this one plays very much like one of those, even though Lippitt had nothing much to do with TV. He was very much a movie director. It plays a lot like a BBC play, this film. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. It can be very effective, that kind of thing. For instance, Nigel Neal's The Year of the Sex Olympics that came out a few years later very much has the same limitations, but of course the script is much better, the actors are much better, and the set design is much more interesting, even though the budgets probably were not entirely dissimilar between the two projects. But I kind of like Spaceflight IC-1 because of that ambition and that attempt to tell a story much grander than the budget, the time, the actors, and the script would allow to a certain extent. It's a bold little film for that, talking about an interstellar colony on basically a 3 or 4 room set. Is a pretty insane thing to do, but they did it, they tried it out, and I don't know how successful it was financially. I'm sure it would have made some money, otherwise there wouldn't have been a couple of other projects that Lippert did. But it's good to fill those gaps and just take a look at these kind of little small interstitial films that aren't the great big things. They're not Barbarella, and they're not The Satan Bug, and they're not Fantastic Voyage and any of those great big tentpole science fiction films of the time. They're small, they're kind of intimate stories, they're trying to tell things in an interesting way, and they're playing with ideas, which is always a lovely thing in films. One of the problems I've got with people remaking films and with people who make films along similar lines, like when Pulp Fiction came out, there were about 100 different imitators of Pulp Fiction. I like people who play with ideas in an original way, and I think this movie does that. Not always successfully, but it does kind of address the problems of this kind of space flight and on the pressures that people would feel going on a one-way journey to another planet. And all credit to them for that. I like films that aren't that wildly ambitious and don't necessarily succeed because they are ambitious and because people actually try to do this kind of stuff. But there's not too much else to say about Spaceflight IC-1. I think it'd be wrong to talk about the movie for as long as the film's running time. But anyway, I'm going to take a break now, and when I get back, we're going to talk about the other film, which is slightly more interesting and a little bit more fun, which is The Earth Dies Screaming, directed by Terence Fisher, who directed a number of fine Hammer films, starring Willard Parker, Virginia Field, and an English character actor I like a lot, Dennis Price.
Suddenly, a man dies at the controls of a train. Suddenly, a car swerves to destruction. Suddenly, a plane dives to death. The Earth dies screaming. Suddenly, death descends on the four corners of the Earth, and only a handful of human beings survive to live in fear, powerless to combat an unknown terror.
Turn it off.
Who are you?
That away, I'm not the enemy.
I don't know who the enemy is.
The Earth dies screaming, and the robots take over. Starring Willard Parker, Virginia Field, Dennis Price,
you said that she was dead.
She was.
She was alive enough tonight, except her eyes.
Well, what was the matter with them?
She hasn't got any eyes.
Here is paralyzing suspense as the Earth dies screaming. Electrifying terror as the Earth dies screaming.
Jeff!
Peggy! Peggy!
The robots.
What? Peggy!
In some ways, The Earth Dies Screaming is a much more ambitious film than Spaceflight IC-1, and more successful with that ambition. It's there right from the start. A lot of it's filmed outdoors and on location, which is a big advantage over the kind of set-bound Spaceflight IC-1. And right from the start, we see the effects of the world being basically destroyed by aliens. They cover the world in a gas which kills people, and only a few people survive because they're in such circumstances that permit them to not be affected by the gas. One person's in an oxygen tent, some other people hide in an old air raid shelter. that kind of thing. At the start, we see train crashes, car crashes, people hanging out of the windows of buildings dead and scattered along suburban streets. There's a really good kind of avant-garde soundtrack by a female composer who did a number of soundtracks in the 1960s, Elizabeth Lutyens. And she did soundtracks for some really interesting little projects like Paranoic, a really good 1963 Hammer film, The Skull, Dr. Terror's House of Horrors, which I've talked about previously, The Terranauts of Psychopath, and a couple of other kind of less well-known projects. Oddly enough, she lived in the village where The Earth Dies Screaming was filmed, which is very, very cool. It's a village in Surrey called Shere, S-H-E-R-E. And that avant-garde soundtrack really adds a lot to this film, which again had a low budget, 62 minutes long, and they're telling the story of A, an alien invasion, B, the total destruction pretty much of human civilization, and C, how a small group of people find out how the invasion is happening and what to do about it and take the first steps to reclaiming the Earth. All of that in 62 minutes on a small budget filmed in a small Surrey village with actors, some of whom were great and some of whom were less so. Willard Parker, the ostensible protagonist of the piece, was a kind of contract actor in Hollywood in the 1940s and 1950s. He's probably his most well-known role is he played Tex, the paramour of Catherine of Grayson's character in the musical Kiss Me, Kate in the 1950s. Not a big role. He was a tall guy, craggy-faced, blonde, wavy hair, but not singularly gifted as an actor. He's okay in this, but no better than a number of other people would have been. It's the sort of role they would have given to somebody like Forrest Tucker. I'm not sure. Did I say Forrest Tucker earlier in the podcast or Forrest Whitaker? If I said Forrest Whitaker, I apologise. I got that wrong. Forrest Whitaker, of course, is an actor of colour, and Forrest Tucker was the guy in F-Troop who had an enormous cock. If you don't believe me, look it up. But anyway, Willard Parker in this movie plays a character whose name is Jeff Nolan. It's one of those generic character names that people got in these kind of movies. Who's a retiring airline pilot who was up in an experimental aircraft at the time the gas wiped out most of the human race. He enters the village in a Range Rover because he's a very practical man and so drives a very practical vehicle and finds a number of other survivors who, for some happenstance, all happen to be in the same village. There's Peggy, played by Virginia Field, who's kind of not quite a love interest. The movie doesn't go long enough for any relationship to develop. Dennis Price, playing Quinn Taggart. Now, Dennis Price, really interesting actor, started out in the 1940s, and they kind of squeezed him into romantic roles in Gainsborough Pictures, where anybody who's seen Dennis Price in any movie knows that Dennis Price was best playing sophisticated upper-class villains rather than heroic characters. So for a number of years, he kind of struggled with the fact that Gainsborough Pictures and the other studios wanted to put him into kind of heroic, dashing, romantic lead roles where he really didn't fit. He did a hell of a lot of films. He had tax troubles. He also was blackmailed at one stage for being gay. This was back, again, we kind of hark back to the movie Victim, where kind of high-profile gay people were very often, while being homosexual was very illegal in England and people were jailed for it, they'd get blackmailed by rent boys and things like that, and it cost them a lot of money. And Dennis Price was one of those people who unfortunately suffered that kind of ugliness in his life. I think he even did a couple of Jess Franco movies toward the end of his career and toward the end of his life as a way of making ends meet. But Dennis Price kind of lifts it up because he's playing a dodgy character. He knows how to pick locks. He has a pistol. And he kind of revels in the scenes that he has, just kind of being slightly bastardly and villainous in the film. And he does lift the film by being in it. Now, the story's pretty simple. A mysterious gas attack kills most of the human population. A few survivors, and again, this is Wikipedia, a few survivors gather in a country inn to figure out a plan for survival. The gas attack, unfortunately, is only the first step in the alien invasion, after which a group of bulletproof killer robots stalk the streets, able to kill people with a mere touch of their hands. And the people they kill come back to life and kind of do their bidding as well. These are quite sophisticated robots, obviously. And one of the kind of scary parts is when one of the characters is killed by the robots and she does come back to life. It's quite an effective scene. Of course, this movie was very ably directed by Terence Fisher, who spent a lot of his career directing movies for Hammer. Curse of the Werewolf, of course, Brides of Dracula, Horror of Dracula, The Revenge of Frankenstein, Dracula, Prince of Darkness, Frankenstein, Created Woman, The Devil Rides Out, which I've talked about on a previous Martian Driving podcast, Frankenstein Must Be Destroyed, Frankenstein, The Monster from Hell. Really kind of good, solid horror director. He knew how to build up tension, and he does do that in a couple of quite effective scenes in The Earth Dies Screaming, which, by the way, is a fucking marvellous title. I really like it, even though there's not a lot of screaming goes on except for one or two little bits. The Earth Dies Screaming is one of those kind of pulpish titles that is incredibly evocative and looks really good on a marquee. And the titles of the film, the movie starts silently with us kind of panning and seeing various shots of dead people after the gas attack. There's a man kind of face down in a gutter in the rain with water running over the side of his face. It's very well done. And all through the movie too, we get to see in the mid-distance corpses lying around the village. They don't forget to kind of populate the scene with some of the dead people in each of them. And they're probably just kind of extras and actors lying around and wearing anoraks and laying on the ground until the scene's finished. And having those bodies around really does add to the atmosphere of this very creepy little film. The survivors end up going to a local army barracks and arming themselves with various gear, some explosives, which they'll need later in the film, rifles and ammunition and that kind of thing. Among the survivors is a young couple, one woman quite pregnant, and her husband, played in the movie by, David Spencer and Anna Polk. Their names are Mel and Lorna. And he's the kind of guy, and I didn't like him from the start, and I'll tell you why. He's got a very pregnant wife, so this car he steals is a fantastic little sports car. So he squeezes a very pregnant woman into a sports car because he wants to drive a sports car, basically. Didn't like him right from the start for that reason. I think it shows a lack of consideration. One of the other people we get in there is a guy wearing a tuxedo who's a little bit cowardly, and he's played by Thorley Walters. Now, Thorley Walters was in any number of Hammer films. He was right up there with Michael Ripper when it came to character roles in Hammer films. Thorley Walters is very effective in it. That's the interesting thing about this film. I think the budget may have been a lot larger than Spaceflight IC-1 for the simple reason that they got a lot of really good character actors in there, people who knew their stuff, could come in, do the gig, and kind of inhabit the characters. And the two that really do that best are Dennis Price and Thorley Walters. They really kind of make it work. The characters are all thinly written. Remember, it's only a 62-minute script. But by kind of adopting the persona that Price and Walters have in movies, they kind of flesh out the thin bits of their characters, and that works really, really well. The robots aren't particularly great. They're very creepy in some ways, but they're kind of up there with 1960s Doctor Who villains, maybe a little bit more. The kind of blank, weird-looking faces they have, the bubble helmets, the kind of quilted backpacks and all that kind of thing, they're very much of their time as far as these things are concerned. But because there's no personality to the robots, they're one of those kind of slow-moving, menacing and implacable enemies. You can't shoot them because they're bulletproof. That kind of invulnerability, even though they are moving slowly, really makes them work. That's something that people know from old Universal horror films and The Indestructible Man and things like that. And that movie that Ron Randell did in the 1950s, what was it called again? Most Dangerous Man Alive. Invulnerable bad guys are always a lot of fun. And having them be bulletproof and having them turn up unexpectedly when people, particularly at night, even though they do look a little bit manky, they are very effective in the movie. And that's one of the things about this film. It kind of gets you into what is known in the trade and is known among science fiction aficionados as the cozy catastrophe. Now, cozy catastrophes were first used in the 1960s critically by a lot of writers who wrote criticism of science fiction for magazines like New Worlds. Cozy catastrophe is the stuff like Day of the Triffids and a lot of John Wyndham's, a lot of John Christopher's stuff and John Wyndham's stuff where the world has an apocalyptic event, but it's all set in the home counties of the UK and people muddle on and survive and in spite of adversity live through it all. It's kind of a cozy middle class apocalypse. And The Earth Die Screaming is very much like that in a way. Everybody gathers in the local pub. The pubs, of course, have rooms, they have alcohol. They're a good central location in the town. So for the survivors to set up in a pub just seems a natural thing in an English village. But it does lead into that argument that the movie is an example of a cozy catastrophe. Nonetheless, the movie works well. The music is scary and avant-garde. The direction is very good. There are some interesting actors in there. The whole setup of having the apocalypse happen in this little village, which again is probably The World's End. Yeah, the Simon Pegg, Edgar Wright, Nick Frost film of a couple of years ago could be seen as a cozy catastrophe as well. I mean, I really do love these two films for that ambition that they have. They're not trying to tell a tiny little story. They're trying to tell an enormous story on a tiny little stage. And that, I do have a hell of a lot of admiration for that. I think it's crazy and mad and counterintuitive. And Robert Lippert and Lippert Films did that in an interesting way. I suppose if you even go back to the 1958-59 version of The Fly, even that was world-changing events, the invention of teleportation, done on a very small scale in a small factory in Quebec. And, of course, this had been done well before this. Roger Corman did a number of things, Last Woman on Earth, for instance. Again, a kind of cozy catastrophe on a very small scale. A lot of these kind of low-budget films did punch above their weight. They weren't scared to have world-shattering events happen off stage. They didn't have budgets for special effects and tornadoes and cyclones and everybody in different cities around the world falling into a heap as a gas kills everyone. They didn't have room for that. They just kind of sketched it in as background and went on with the core story they're trying to tell, which was, in the case of Spaceflight IC-1, about survival and about how small communities kind of bond together and overcome adversity and tyranny. And in this one, of course, it's a very similar theme in The Earth Die Screaming. How do you overcome a seemingly implacable foe by being smarter than them and working out what their weakness is? It's an old template for science fiction films, but these two do it in a kind of interesting way. I've got a great fondness for this kind of film. They were the ones that I saw late at night on television when I wasn't supposed to be up out of bed. And that kind of naughtiness of doing that adds spice for me in rewatching this kind of film. Really love it and really kind of appreciate what they were trying to do. Of course, it's a genre that keeps going now. A lot of the Sci-Fi Channel films and the films made by a studio called The Asylum are very much along those lines. Yes, they do large-scale, ropey science fiction special effects, which are laughably bad. But for the most part, they're about small groups of people facing Armageddon. It's an endlessly regurgitated genre, in a way. And it dates back to films like René Clair's Paris qui dort, where everybody in Paris, except for a couple of people at the top of the Eiffel Tower, get frozen in time, and the people come down and frolic through Paris until everybody wakes up again. Again, it's a kind of cozy catastrophe stuff. And it's nice to have that continuity of subgenre from 1928 when Paris qui dort came out, right the way through to the 20-teens when Sci-Fi Channel is showing ropey
and very self-aware versions of this same kind of story. And I'm sure we're going to see more of it in the future. We may even end up with augmented reality cozy catastrophe scenarios. Who knows? The possibilities are endless. But anyway, I'm going to leave it there with this podcast. They're short films, and so it's going to be a somewhat shorter podcast than usual. Again, thank you for listening. It's been a lot of fun revisiting these films. And thank you, as always, to the Patreon subscribers who give me their pocket change so that I can keep the podcast going and buy some interesting films so that I don't have to talk about Steven Spielberg movies. Don't get me started on Steven Spielberg. And to all of you out there, all across this clay and granite planet, look after yourselves. Enjoy your movie watching. Take care. Look both ways before you cross the street. Keep watching the skies. And I'll be back next week with a new Paleo Cinema podcast, and in 2 weeks with another Martian Drive-In podcast. Look after yourselves, and I'm going to leave you with a song just to flesh out the time of this podcast. Mothership Connection by Parliament, then followed by the credits to the podcast in the style of movie credits to thank the Patreon subscribers. Take care of yourselves.
Well, all right. Starcha, citizens of the universe, recording angels, we have returned to claim the pyramid. Partying on the mothership, I am the mothership connection. Get down in 3D, light year groove. Well, all right, you hear any noise, ain't nobody but me and the boy. Get down. Hit it, fellas. Put a glide in your stride and a dip in your hip and come on to the mothership. Loose boot, doing the bump. Hustle on over here. This far. Mothership Connection. Home of the people, the bomb. Doing it in 3D. Put on my sunglasses here so I can see what I'm doing. But a party. Star Child here, citizens of the universe. I bring forth to you the good time on the mothership. Are you here? Sing, fellas. Thank you. want it in 3D. So good is good to me. Hit the bank.
Thank you to all of the Patreon subscribers, and here are the credits in the style of movie credits to acknowledge and thank all of them. We have Tom, our focus puller, Sarah, our special effects technician, Ian, our caterer, Grant, our technicolor consultant, Claire, our script doctor, Gary, our prop master, Morris, our music director, Jan, our dialect coach, Armin, our key grip, Matt, our rattlesnake wrangler, Elaine, our scientific advisor, Julia, our casting director, Chris, our camera operator, Christopher, our gaffer, Miss Jane, the wardrobe mistress, Tansy, the foley artist, Alyssa, the location scout, Mark, our second unit director, Paul, our special makeup effects director, Tammy, our donut wrangler, Tim, our New York unit director, Rabbi Steve, our spiritual advisor, Steve, our script doctor, Dylan, our goat wrangler, Eric, our set security lead, Carrie, our second script doctor, Richard, our set photographer, and our extras, Kathleen, Mark, and David. And let's not forget Steve Sullivan, our director of monster effects, and Richard C., our transportation co-captain. So thank you very much to all the subscribers, and you too can subscribe at patreon.com/paleocinema.